So there's a lot of jewelry making in the parsha this week. When we studied it on Monday as part of our Torah chat program, it was very unclear, given that we are not master jewelers, how they were doing it. There were small stones on which were engraved many names, for example, and many jewels laid in, lapidaries laid in to the priestly breastplate. But what I've been thinking about a lot this week is the imperfection of art. And the metaphors we use for God as potter, for example, obviously they did not have production and machined pottery back then. So pottery is essentially made irregular, just as we and God's hands are made irregular. And this draws me to the Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, which itself is sort of an embracing of the imperfection as part of the art, and that nothing perfect is as beautiful as something slightly irregular, slightly flawed, which in turn led me to Leonard Cohen's anthem.
The birds, they sang at the break of day. Start again. Hear them say, don't dwell on what has passed away.
So I want to return to that concept of wabi-sabi, but first I want to present the idea, as is presented quite often in Talmud, that the priestly work was somehow perfect. There was never a bad odor in the temple. The priestly garments were always polished and new. That idea is even carried into the 19th century with the Sfat Emet, Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Leib Alter of Gur. And when we talk about things of this parasha, like the menorah oil, the priestly vestments, he says that they connect to mind and body, and the phrase used about them is lechavod ultifaret, for glory and honor. And he quotes Ecclesiastes saying, your garment should always be white and your head should lack no ointment. But I think what he's understanding lechavod ultifaret as, just as the Tanya did, the first of the Lubavitch Rebbe's, is this sort of supernal perfection, this unachievable and somewhat unattainable efforts of the mind and body to reach a clarity and a purity, which I've always thought is like the idea of a guru, and I don't mean the technical term of a East Asian guru, but really just the concept, the lowercase g guru, that there's someone out there more holy than we, that there's some possibility of perfection, I think is always at odds with real religious work. That if our goal is perfection and not progress, we're always going to fall short. And we ultimately will wind up shaming ourselves in such ways that we might give up on the religious enterprise or the spiritual enterprise. So I want to think about those priestly garments because I always love it. Sort of the image I have in mind is our Passover tablecloth, or even a Shabbat tablecloth that you take out once a year, and after a year or three, it's stained. Right? You've stained it with brisket juice, you've stained it with wine, you've stained it with horseradish, you know, and some people bleach it out at the end of Pesach, and some people keep it in as a reminder of previous holidays. And I'm currently sitting in our newest room, we had a lot of remodeling done and turned this beautiful screen porch into a glassed-in space. And, you know, it's pristine. And as I moved some furniture, I dented a wall. I created a nick. And I was both upset and relieved. Like, oh, there's the first dent, right? You know, you have a brand new car and you're like, oh, I want to drive so carefully. So I think what we don't consider about those priestly garments, they seem so white, pure, impermeable, and implausible. I really think it, contrary to the way they're presented in Raiders of the Lost Ark or in Christian photography or imagery online, they were covered with blood and oil. They didn't have bleach much back then or things that could really remove stains. And even today, blood and oil are very hard to remove. And as I showed you, asked you to kind of look at in the Torah reading I did, they're flecked. You know, there was this flinging of blood and oil and watering of, sort of drenching of oil on Aaron and his son's heads as they were consecrated to the priestly service. Now, there's a talk that once a year these garments were purified, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were cleaned. That means they had some ritual purification to purge the inherent humanness of Aaron and his sons, right? That everyone makes a mistake and everyone needs to make amends. And so there was a purging ritual for the priests and high priests every year. But it doesn't seem likely to me that the garments looked immensely better. There was still the residue of all the previous work. Even the high priest who only did it once a year, there was residue of all that great work. And so we also talk about the candelabrum in the Mishkan and then temple. And it says that you are in the very first verse of Tetzaveh, V'ata tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael v'yiku alecha shemen zayit zach gatit lema'or v'laha'alot ner tamid. And just like that jewelry, in our Torah study group, we had a little bit of tough time understanding this. I can't easily translate all those words. So we used some of the translations that exist. And maybe it means clear beaten olive oil or crushed olive oil or pressed olive oil used to illuminate or to light. That it was as pure as you can get olive oil. I mean, I guess extra virgin. And they didn't have, you know, corruption. I don't know if you're aware of this, but a lot of olive oils you get are flavored canola oils tampered with in transit and then resold, repackaged as olive oil. Presumably that didn't happen in ancient Israel, but it seems unlikely that they had the filters, sieves, and mechanical and industrial processes to get the level of clarity in their olive oil that we have today. And so this clear and beaten olive oil was as good as it gets. Talmud says that just as olive oil leads light only after pounding, so are humans' greatest potentials only realized under pressure of adversity. That is we. That is the human endeavor, right? It's not to be improbably perfect. It's not to be lily white as the linen garments of the priests probably never were. And I think fresh pressed linen is always sort of like an ecru color. It's always a little bit off white. So the goal of our ancestors was to be as pure as possible with this constant recognition through the sacrificial system that amends always had to be made. That when there were physical issues, among the many we could talk about our death and contact with a dead carrion, there are all others that are a little more graphic, they always needed to be remedied. There was always a remedy available. It wasn't that we are presumed to be perfect, it was that we worked towards it and constantly, it was a continual process. And the darkness, the tragedy, the trauma, someone said to me recently that no trauma ever goes away. Right? Every trauma we've ever experienced from 4 years on to 40 years to 80 years is carried with us. Every loss, every pain, every D on a paper, every car wreck is always born within our soul and often within the framing of our body. I know people who still have neck problems from a car accident in their 30s. So the point I think our Torah is making is that all these blood splatters and all these oil taints are part of who we are and of value in the spiritual practice. The Midrash on this week's parasha notes that Rabbi Barachia says, look at the eyeball. You don't see through the white, you see through the black. The darkness is what allows us to see. There are many other quotes like this in our tradition. And in the creation of the candelabrum and its use and the lighted materials, their use in the temple and tabernacle, we see repeatedly, especially in Midrash and Talmud, that God didn't ask for them. They're not for God, they're for us. Right? Like the light ahead of us, the light that draws us forward spiritually, God doesn't need it. God is maybe perfect, but most of our traditional sources don't indicate that either. But we are inherently broken, and that is to our good. That's where the light gets in. That's through that brokenness, through that simplicity, through that, that's our purity. Right? The word for purity also means simplicity. So we're not intended to be production pottery that is perfectly circular. We're intended to be pottery made by a potter, in this case, God. But just as every other pottery is somewhat ovoid rather than circular, and as I pointed out, when Karen sells her pottery, if there's a nick, she puts the nick in the back where the customer doesn't see it. Right? We do that too. We put our most flawed parts away where no one sees them, but they're always there. And they're part, again, of how the light gets in. And those are the life lessons that matter. That's what makes us not just human and not just holy, but also learning and growing, and the beauty of learning and growing. You know, it's easy to lose sight of that when you're a student, that learning starts to feel like a chore. But when you, as a rabbi or other, come to adult education classes and you see the person who I notice it extremely intensely from is Arnold Cohen. He loves to learn, even to this age. And I feel unfair saying that because I look around at your pictures and I can think of dozens of people who strive to learn. But there's, for some reason, Arnold, you can see it on his face more obviously. So that's the work, right? The work is not to be perfect, is not to get the linen polished and scrubbed white, but to live with all those flaws and imperfections and to learn from them. So we were to return back to the Torah study of Monday. There's this thing called the ephod. And like so many of the things in this section of the Torah and the later parts of Exodus about tabernacle and priestly service, it's vague enough that a lot of things could be true. So we don't 100% know what it was, what it looked like. You'll see pictures online that are, they all follow the details, but they're all a little subtly different. And the ephod is most of all a word that has no understanding. Even Rashi, I was relieved in my research later this week that just as we weren't able to understand what the ephod was on Monday, even Rashi, the greatest of all the rabbinic exegetes, didn't know, some 900 plus years ago. So he says, I haven't heard nor have I found in the Talmud an explanation of what this thing is. He says, and I want to quote this specifically, my heart tells me that it's tied on the back, its width is the width of a person's back, its form is like an apron worn by princesses when they ride horses. So he doesn't use that phrase, I think, I believe it to be, my heart tells me, but rarely. But when he does, it's fascinating that even Rashi, who carried these immense various traditions that he synthesized for students of his era and all eras since, didn't know this one. So the Hasidic tradition offers this beautiful parable. It's not clear to me that Rashi did it. But the Baal Shem Tov said, everything that a person sees or hears should serve them as a lesson in service to God. Right? So how did Rashi get this idea that it's like some sort of royal apron? So the Hasidic Rebbes suggest that they don't have any cause to say this, but it's a nice idea. You know, why did Rashi even have interaction with princesses, right? It's not, the Jewish communities consistently through Europe were sort of peripheral and not only not treated well by the elite, but they avoided the elite at all costs because there were a lot of dangers involved. But anyway, the imagination of the Hasidic tradition is that one day Rashi was in the forest, maybe, and came across a party of noble women on horseback and wondered what was the divine providence that showed him this apparently meaningless or even dangerous or even un-Jewish scene. And then someday later, he was struggling to describe the ephod and he realized that was the thing. That was what it was. It was these horseback aprons that noble women wore. The image I struggled with was a butcher's apron. But I want to leave you with that image, this kind of comedy of Rashi being in the woods and having, it's almost like Tevye. It's a story that would have fit in Tevye the Dairyman, which was the source of Fiddler on the Roof. this idea of just being in the woods and seeing this odd sight in the, you know, the Tsar's noblewomen, that's what it really feels like. And so that everything comes at us for our spiritual purpose, and that everything we can draw a lesson from. And we're not intended to know these things inherently or to be holy in ourselves, with these little cracks and these oddities and these irregularities in life. It's not only where the light gets in, but how we get better, stronger, and more learned with our lives.